This is audiobook in MP3 of the classic UFO book, The Coming of the Saucers. A documentary report on SKY objects that have mystified the world. By Kenneth Arnold and Raymond Palmer. From 1952. For reading, search the PDF file online, as can also be used for following this reading here. Contents. Acknowledgements. Introduction. Chapter 1. How the Big Story Happened. Chapter 2. The Tacoma Affair. Chapter 3. The Mysterious Informant. Chapter 4. Death Takes a Hand. Chapter 5. Get Out, For Your Own Good. Chapter 6. Project Saucer Report. Chapter 7. Comments on the Project Saucer Report. Chapter 8. 1,000 Years of Flying Saucers. Chapter 9. The Strange Foo Fighters. Chapter 10. Foreign Sightings. Chapter 11. Reports from American Observers. Chapter 12. Analysis versus Opinion. Chapter 13. Camera Story of the Saucers. Introduction. It is my impression that everyone, no matter what part they play in this existence that seems to go on into infinity, has a special purpose or a special task or a special reason for being what they are and for doing the things they do. I don't say that we are placed here by a divine providence to accomplish a great mission. Nothing so egotistical. Perhaps it is purely a personal reason, merely to add to our own experience, our mental growth, our ability to become a functional part in a whole of society which may be more vast than we dream. When I was a boy, I collected green grasshoppers. I went swimming in a swimming hole like the other boys, but unlike them, it seems, I learned how by such apparently foolish waste of time as watching tadpoles swim and trying to imitate their motions. When I was 12, it was terribly important that I become a Boy Scout. Again, it was because of the little things in nature that I loved to study that I wanted to don that uniform. I realized that a great ambition the day my mother proudly pinned an eagle badge on my shirt front in a court of honor in Minot, North Dakota. It was during scouting that swimming and diving became one of my most enjoyed activities, and I served several years as a field representative for the American Red Cross Life Saving Service. I developed myself to a healthy robustness. Then I took up riding motorcycles, and nearly killed myself. The scars I still have remind me that a life carelessly and adventurously lived can become a bit complex. I had my first airplane ride from Earl T. Vance of Great Falls, Montana when I was 14 years old. I'll never forget that day on the North Hill at Minot. It seemed the greatest thrill of my life. When I was 16, I took my first flying lesson. I had no money to pay, but my father furnished the gasoline for the plane from his filling station in Crosby, North Dakota. How I wished I could continue flying. But it was far too expensive at that time. As a little boy, my head was always on the cloud. The reason I enjoyed bird study, I think, was because I so envied their ability to fly. Then, suddenly being a football player seemed important. Glenn Jarrett, my Minot High School coach, somehow achieved enough coordination between my brain and my limbs to enable my being placed on the All-State North Dakota football teams in 1932 and 1933. Finishing high school, even with football, was quite a struggle. Education from books didn't seem nearly as necessary as going fishing. Somehow I graduated, and went on to the University of Minnesota with the promise of a job from Bernie Bierman, at that time head football coach there. Except for my promised job, my total assets amounted to $57 and a Model T Ford. About all I remember of my short-lived college career was the dishes I washed for Chris Kopilis of the Bridge Cafe on 14th and 4th in Minneapolis, Minnesota. My football interests vanished with a knee injury that put an end to them. The depression was at its deepest point when I took up selling. I drafted from sportswear into fire control work. I stayed with selling fire extinguishers because I felt it was doing some good for humanity besides giving me an income to provide for my wife, two daughters, one partly paid for home, an airplane, and pets of various shapes and colors. Since 1944 I have spent more than 4,000 hours in the air flying in mountainous country. I call on my customers in 5 western states by plane, and I take an active part in the Idaho search and rescue mercy flights, as well as acting as a deputy sheriff for the Ada County, Idaho, Sheriff's Aerial Posse. I also act as relief deputy federal United States Marshal, and frequently fly federal prisoners up to McNeil Island Federal Penitentiary. I has been nearly 5 years since my original observation of the formation of flying saucers over the Cascade Mountains. It is not difficult for me to recall the true events as they took place, since everything that happened was dictated on sound records within a very short period afterward. What I saw over the Cascades in the state of Washington, as impossible as it may seem, is fact. I never asked, wanted, nor expected any notoriety for accidentally being in the right spot at the right time to observe the chain of 9 mysterious objects. I reported something any would have reported. If, reasoning along patriotic lines alone, I had not reported by observations, I would have been rightfully considered disloyal to my country. My observations were not due to any particular sensitivity of eyesight, nor to any abnormal or supernatural ability. I'm positive that any pilot at the same place at the same time would have observed what you did. By no stretch of imagination can I classify my observations in the categories of illusion, hallucination, apparition or vision. Since that day I have been repeatedly questioned and investigated by such agencies as Military Intelligence, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Bureau of Internal Revenue, Central Intelligence, Marine Intelligence, private detective agencies, individuals, and just plain busybodies. I have been subjected to ridicule, much loss of time and money, newspaper notoriety, magazine stories, reflections on my honesty, my character, my business dealings. In short, the amount of actual persecution that has come about, whether intended as such or not, because of my accidental involvement in what has become the strangest story ever told, has been a continual source of amazement to me. To me the search has not ended. But participation of the sort involved in the fatal Tacoma incident, in which 2 Central Intelligence military investigators lost their lives and a $200,000 aircraft was destroyed, is something that I would refuse to enter into again, largely because it is my conviction that nothing concrete will be learned by such obtuse methods. This thing is big. It is something to which we most certainly ought to have the answer. It is my conviction that the facts already at hand must not be buried beneath a mass of official stupidity and a smokescreen of variant idiocies. It is time the truth was sifted from the untruth, the facts from the fakery, the real flying saucer from the fanciful. It may be the most vitally important fact of our time. Kenneth Arnold, Boise, Idaho, February 10, 1952. Chapter 1. How the Big Story Happened. It was Tuesday, June 24, 1947. I had just finished installing some firefighting apparatus for Central Air Service at Chehalis, Washington. The job finished, I began a chat with Herb Kritzer, Chief Test Pilot for Central Air Service. We talked, among other things, about the possible location of a lost C-46 Marine transport which had gone down in the mountains. I decided to look for it. It meant a $5,000 reward, and I hoped that via my proposed route to Yakima, Washington, I might be lucky enough to find it. I decided to spend enough time in the air in the vicinity of Mount Rainier to make a good attempt at locating the wreckage. I was flying a specially designed mountain airplane, and having had considerable experience in this type of flying, I felt qualified to undertake the dangerous search. I took off from Chehalis, Washington Airport at approximately 2 o'clock in the afternoon with the intention in mind of delaying my trip to Yakima for at least an hour, which I would spend on top, and in and around the high plateau of Mount Rainier. I flew directly toward this plateau, which has an elevation varying from 9 to over 10,000 feet. There are a number of things that are extremely important in handling aircraft on a search mission over mountainous terrain. Number 1 is a meticulous ground inspection of your airplane before beginning, not one of the ordinary checks such as gasoline and oil, but inspection of all wiring and movable parts of the aircraft which in any might cause a forced landing in treacherous country. This is very necessary. The consumption of gas is best judged in an aircraft not by gasoline gauge alone, but by knowing that your tank is full, knowing its capacity, and the number of gallons your engine consumes each hour. An 8-day clock with a sweep secondhand is one of the essentials in my aircraft. By 1947 I had learned through experience that care and thoroughness of a planned flight is the best insurance that a pilot can have. I did plan this flight in this manner on June 24, 1947. It was during this search and while making a turn of 180 degrees over Mineral, Washington, at approximately 9,200 feet altitude, that a tremendously bright flash lit up the surfaces of my aircraft. I was startled. I thought I was very close to collision with some other aircraft whose approach I had not noted. I spent the next 20 to 30 seconds urgently searching the sky all around, to the sides, above and below me, in an attempt to determine where the flash of light had come from. The only actual plane I saw was a DC-4 far to my left and rear, apparently on its San Francisco to Seattle run. My momentary explanation to myself was that some lieutenant in a P-51 had given me a buzz job across my nose and that it was the sun reflecting from the surface of his wings as he passed that has caused the flash. Before I had time to collect my thoughts or to find any close aircraft, the flash happened again. This time I caught the direction from which it had come. I observed, far to my left and to the north, a formation of very bright objects coming from the vicinity of Mount Baker, flying very close to the mountain tops and traveling at tremendous speed. At first I couldn't make out their shapes as they were still at a distance of over 100 miles. I could see the formation was going to pass directly in front of me, as it was flying at approximately 170 degrees. I watched as these objects rapidly neared the snow border of Mount Rainier, all the time thinking to myself that I was observing a whole formation of jets. In group count, such as I have used in counting cattle and game from the air, they numbered 9. They were flying diagonally in an echelon formation with a larger gap in their echelon between the first 4 and the last 5. What startled me most at this point was the fact that I could not find any tails on them. I felt sure that, being jets, they had tails, but figured they must be camouflaged in some way so that my eyesight could not perceive them. I knew that Air Force was very artful in the knowledge and use of camouflage. I observed the object's outlines plainly as they flipped and flashed along against the snow and also against the sky. Since this formation of craft was at almost right angles to me and was traveling from north to south, I was in an excellent position to clock their speed. I determined to make an attempt to do so. It was a beautifully sunny afternoon and the giant bulks of both Mount Rainier and Mount Adams made perfect markers. Now, clocking speeds by only your sweep second hand cannot be entirely accurate because several seconds could be lost in breaking your gaze to observe your clock. I recall that when the first craft of this formation jetted to the southward from the snow-based cleft of Mount Rainier, my second hand was approaching the top of my hour dial and the time was within a few seconds to 1:03. I can't distinctly remember whether the 8-day clock on my instrument panel was set on Pacific time, Mountain time, daylight saving time, or slow time. I never thought of checking this with my wristwatch. I believe my 8-day clock was on mountain time. I was fascinated by this formation of aircraft. They didn't fly like any aircraft I had ever seen before. In the first place, their echelon formation was backward from that practiced by our Air Force. The elevation of the first craft was greater than that of the last. They flew in a definite formation, but erratically. As I described them at the time, their flight was like speedboats on rough water or similar to the tail of a Chinese kite that I once saw blowing in the wind. Or maybe it would be best to describe their flight characteristics as very similar to a formation of geese, in a rather diagonal chain-like line, as if they were linked together. As I put it to newsmen in Pendleton, Oregon, they flew like a saucer would if you skipped it across the water. Another characteristic of these craft that made a tremendous impression on me was how they fluttered and sailed, tipping their wings alternatively and emitting those very bright blue-white flashes from their surfaces. At the time I did not get the impression that these flashes were emitted by them, but rather that it was the sun's reflection from the extremely highly polished surface of their wings. Even though they held a constant direction, they swerved in and out of the high mountain peaks which are found on the hogsback of the Cascade Mountains between Mount Rainier and Mount Adams. I determined my distance from their pathway to be in the vicinity of 23 miles because I knew where I was, and they revealed their true position by disappearing from my sight momentarily behind a jagged peak that just juts out from the base of Mount Rainier proper, considering that I was flying all this time in the direction of their formation. This determination can be only approximate, but it is not too far off. Between Mount Rainier and Mount Adams there is a very high plateau with quite definite north and south edges. Part of this chain-like formation traveled above this plateau toward Mount Adams, while part of the formation actually dipped below the near edge. As the first unit of these craft cleared the southernmost edge of this background, the last of the formation was just entering the northern edge. I later flew over this plateau in my plane and came to a close approximation that this whole formation of craft, whatever they were, formed a chain in the neighborhood of 5 miles long. As the last of this group of objects sped past and seemed to gather altitude at a point beyond the southernmost crest of Mount Adams, I glanced at the sweep second hand of my instrument clock. As closely as I could determine, this strange formation of aircraft had covered the distance between Mount Rainier to the north and Mount Adams to the south in 1 minute and 42 seconds. I can say honestly that I was amazed, thinking all the time, what will these aeronautical engineers dream up next? Although readily explaining it all in this way in my mind, I definitely did have an eerie feeling about the whole experience. I tried to focus my mind on a continued search for the downed C-46 which had crashed some months earlier with 32 Marines aboard, but somehow the $5,000 didn't seem important. I wanted to get on to Yakima and tell some of the boys what I had seen. Around airports, pilots are continually arguing about how fast our Army and Navy jets and missiles really can go. Most pilots conceded that the fastest aircraft that had been invented at that time could go in the vicinity of 700 miles per hour. Up to this point I hadn't done any paper figuring on the distance and time, but I felt sure this formation of strange craft was traveling in excess of 1,000 miles an hour. It was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon when I landed at Yakima and went straight to Al Baxter, General Manager of Central Aircraft. I met him in his outer office and rather breathlessly asked to see him in private. He dropped whatever it was he was doing, and in his private office I related the story of my observation and drew him pictures of what I had seen. I recall that he looked at me in a rather puzzled way, but seemed quite positive that I hadn't gone crazy and wasn't seeing things. He called in several of his flight pilots and helicopter instructors to listen to my story. The high point of my enthusiasm got its top knocked off when one of the helicopter pilots said, "Ah, it's just a flight of those guided missiles from Moses Lake." I proceeded to gather my scattered wits together, got back in my airplane, and took off for Pendleton, Oregon. I remembered that I had forgotten to mention the fact that one of those craft looked different from the rest, was darker and of a slightly different shape, and that I hadn't told the Yakima boys that I had clocked the speed of this formation within fairly accurate limits. While flying to Pendleton I took my map from its snap folder on the extreme edge of my instrument panel, grabbed a ruler, and began figuring mathematically miles per hour. Figuring and flying my airplane at the same time was a little confusing, and I thought my figures were wrong and that I had better wait until I landed at Pendleton to do some serious calculating. When I landed at the large airfield at Pendleton there was quite a group of people to greet me. When I got out of my plane no one said anything. They just stood around and looked at me. I don't recall just how the subject came up in those first few minutes after I had landed, But before very long it seemed everybody around the airfield was listening to the story of my experience. I mentioned the speed I had calculated but assured everybody that I was positive that my mathematics were lousy. I don't know how many fellows sat down and started figuring it out. When it kept coming out in excess of 1700 miles an hour, I thought, holy smoke, we're taking the measurement of distance far too high up on both Mount Rainier and Mount Adams. So we took a measurement of the very base, as closely as it could be determined, and which I knew from the map was far below the snow line. The distance was 39.8 miles. Even covering this distance, which was so far on the conservative sides that I knew it was incorrect, we still had a speed of over 1350 miles per hour. To me, that evening, that was that. They were guided missiles, robotically controlled. I knew that speeds of this velocity the human body simply could not stand, particularly considering the flipping, erratic movements of these strange craft. After talking to the editor of the East Oregonian newspaper, I was fairly convinced that it was some new government invention along the line of guided missiles. I could almost tell what this editor thought when the story went scudding over the news wires, that the government had taken this way to announce a new principle of flight. I could have gone to sleep that night if the reporters, newsmen, and press agencies of every conceivable description had left me alone. I didn't share the general excitement. I can't begin to estimate the number of people, letters, telegrams and phone calls I tried to answer. After 3 days of this hubbub, I came to the conclusion that I was the only sane one in the bunch. From then on, if I was to go by the number of reports that came in of other sightings and of which I kept close track, I thought it wouldn't be long before there would be one of these things in every garage. In order to stop what I thought was a lot of foolishness, and since I couldn't get any work done, I went out to the airport, cranked up my airplane, and flew home to Boise. It wasn't long after I arrived home when Dave Johnson called on me. Dave Johnson is aviation editor of the Idaho Statesman newspaper, and a man of respected ability and intelligence in matters related to military and civilian aviation. When I caught the look in his eye and the tone of his words, flying saucers suddenly took on a different and a serious significance. The doubt he displayed of the authenticity of my story told me, and I am sure he was in a position to know, that it was not a new military guided missile, and that if what I had seen was true, it did not belong to the good old USA. It was then I really began to wonder. No one could have watched the news wires closer than I did between June 28 and July 3. Not only flying saucers were being seen, but phenomena of one kind or another appeared to be happening everywhere. At home we began to feel like we were living in Grand Central Station. When my friend, Colonel Paul Wieland, who had just returned from Germany where he had served over the Marmady case and on the Nuremberg trials as a judge, phoned me and said, "Let's go fishing," I took him up on it, but quick. We got our tackle together, left our wives home to guard the fore, and took off for Sekiu, Washington. Sekiu is way out on the Olympic Peninsula. The fishing should have been at its best, and it was a long way from people. We had a beautiful flight, and the afternoon of the following day landed in what I think is the only cow pasture in Sekiu. All during the flight I had my newly purchased movie camera ready just in case. The only part of our conversation up to the time we arrived in Sekiu that I thought really interesting was when Colonel Paul told me definitely that artillery shells could be seen quite easily traveling at 600 to 700 miles an hour if you are in the right position, and they are quite small compared to a plane. It seems that some press reporter had made the remark that aircraft traveling at speeds of 1200 miles an hour or more would be invisible to eyesight. This only confirmed in my mind that my calculation and timing were not nearly so inaccurate as some newspaper experts were leading people to believe. After tying the airplane solidly to a couple of fence posts, we got permission to leave our plane there. The rancher was extremely kind and drove us down to the village by the ocean inlet. We were all set for a good rest with the prospect of good fishing the next day when we found out that most of the fishermen were not in their boards and had not even gone out fishing. The water was as red as blood. Thousands of Chinook salmon with which the inlet was teeming were dying from a mysterious red tide. I looked at Colonel Paul, and the Colonel looked at me. It was all very puzzling. In talking to the townspeople, we found that they had buried a man that morning who had eaten oysters evidently infected. Why the peculiar, red, jelly-like substance that could be found everywhere in the sea. The next morning, in spite of the red tide, we took a short boat trip around the inlet. Even if the fish were worth eating, they couldn't have been caught. Hundreds of them were leaping out of the water, some as high as 6 feet, trying to shake off the jelly-like substance that was poisoning them. There was nothing for us to do but turn around and fly home. In leaving the cow pasture that day and circling high over the little village of Sekiu, we could plainly see the edges of the red water below us. It looked to me rather like a gob of something had fallen out of the sky. Even though the scientists had a name for it, I admitted red tides into my collection of phenomena along with flying saucers. It was on this same day, July 5, 1947, that I met Captain E.J. Smith and co-pilot Ralph Stevens. Colonel Paul Wieland and I took our last disappointed look at Sekiu and the Redwater and headed towards Seattle, flying at an elevation of about 4,000 feet. The sky was clear as crystal and we had a brisk west wind on our tail of about 20 miles per hour. It wasn't until I landed at Boeing Field to gas up my plane that I heard about the sighting and experience of United Airlines Flight Trip 105, which had left Boise, Idaho at 9:04 p.m. the night before. No better person in all of the personnel of United Airlines could have been picked to verify my story that we were not alone in the air than Captain E.J. Smith. He is probably the most highly thought of and respected veteran pilot that flies the airlines. His sighting was supported and verified by the entire crew of his DC-3. About 8 minutes after takeoff from Boise's Municipal Airport, he and co-pilot Ralph Stevens first observed 5 discs flying what appeared to be a loose formation. Not believing their own eyes, they called Marty Morrow, stewardess, to the cockpit, did not tell her what they were seeing through the windshield of their plane. They asked her to look, so in no way could the power of suggestion have influenced her observation. Upon looking through the window of the cockpit, she exclaimed, "Why, there's a formation of those flying discs." While they were watching, these 5 discs seemed to take off at a tremendous speed and 4 more came into view. 3 of these discs clustered together and the 4th was flying by itself far off in the distance. They were under observation for more than 10 minutes. I was so excited about their observation that I think I purchased every paper at the terminal building newsstand. In one of the papers there was even a photograph, the first photograph of a flying disc that I had seen. It had been taken by Frank Ryman, a Coast Guard yeoman. He had taken his picture the night before. In my excitement, I completely forgot about Colonel Paul Wieland, who was standing by my airplane. I rushed madly uptown to the Seattle offices of the International News Service to see the blown-up prints of the picture. I remember what a tough time I had finding the International News Service. I don't know how many hills Seattle has, but by the time I reached their office I was completely out of breath. I asked to see the picture. Their reporter appeared happy enough to show it to me but demanded to know who I was. I had become reporter shy by this time but had no alternative but to give him my name. When I did, he grabbed me by my arm and rushed me from his office down to the anteroom of the news building. There for the first time I met Captain E.J. Smith and his co-pilot, Stevens. They were gazing with lifted eyebrows at the photograph that had been taken by Frank Ryman. As I recall it, I felt like a runt compared to Big Smithy. He towered head and shoulders above me, and when I shook hands with him it was like shaking hands with the big transport he flies. A kinder or more friendly man I have never met, and Ralph Stevens was justly proud to fly co-pilot with such an airman. After the International News Service had taken our picture observing this photograph, we all went out for coffee, all talking at the same time of our unusual experience. Here is the story as Big Smithy told it to me. We landed our DC-3 at Boise, Idaho shortly before 9 last night and, afraid to be late in schedule, We took off promptly at 9:04. The weather was perfect.